The Back Nine Boys Golf Show. All about golf, from putting to driving, from hooks to whatever. Now, here's your host of the Back Nine Boys Golf Show, Rich Stiles.
Good morning and welcome to the show. The Back Nine Boys is brought to you by Bridgestone Golf. Play the Tour B ball with Mindset Technology. By the club at Sea Palms. By PXG, you've never played like this before. By RSM, proud sponsor of the RSM Classic, giving back to our community. By Stitch Golf, dress your game. And by CJ's Italian Restaurant, known for their deep dish and thin crust peaches, plus much, much more. Check out their full menu at CJsItalianRestaurant.com. Our guest, John Peterson, 2011 Jones Cup winner, who came back this year to play again. So, John, welcome to the Back Nine Boys.
Yeah, Rich, I'm happy to be here. That was a fun week for me, and I'm looking forward to going back for many years.
Yeah. Well, tell me a little bit about the 2011 Jones Cup win that you had. You got into a playoff with a guy who's currently on tour. Tell me a little bit about that.
You know, that guy, you know, it's debatable who has had a better career since then. But, you know, you might have heard of him as a young man. He was still in high school at the time, but his name was Jordan Spieth. And we had similar final rounds back then. It was, I think I shot 4 under in the third round. I remember the weather being awful, but I was about 15th place or so, you know, going into the final round. So I really didn't have any pressure on me and could kind of freewheel the day. And, you know, that either goes one of two ways in golf, right? I mean, you usually either shoot a lot or not much. And that day I just happened to have a few putts fall and had a few good breaks, shot 4 under, got in a playoff, and happened to make birdie on number one at Ocean Forest to beat Jordan. And, you know, I didn't really realize at the time how big of a deal that was in amateur golf, because I hadn't really won a really big amateur golf tournament yet. And I'd been in contention in Sunny Hand and a few other ones, but that Jones Cup win kind of spurred me on through the spring semester of my senior year at LSU. And, you know, I had a really, really good spring, and it was all because of the momentum from that tournament.
So after graduation, you decided to turn pro. Tell me a little bit about that journey.
Well, so back then, we're talking 15 years ago,
right?
Which doesn't seem like a ton of time, but in the last 15 years, guys coming out of college and turning professional in the golf world has changed a ton, right? Back then, it was a big deal if you got a $50,000 signing bonus from a club company, and that was it. If you were a first-team All-American, maybe you would get that. Now you're seeing guys come out of college and get millions of dollars to play clubs. And even in, you know, you're hearing about guys in college getting $250,000 for NIL deals. So it was just a different time, right? And so I turned professional that year in 2011 and really had a rocky start, a really, really tough start. I failed at Q school. And then once the calendar turned over to 2012, I started playing mini tours and didn't have status anywhere. You know, I eventually was able to Monday qualify for the PGA Tour in Memphis in 2012 and then the U.S. Open after that. And after that U.S. Open, that kind of took my career off to the next step that I had not experienced before.
And tell me a little bit about what happened after that U.S. Open experience, as far as your professional career.
I mean, like when you have a career defining moment, so to say, like that, I was almost dead broke before that U.S. Open. Like I had missed a ton of cuts on mini tours. And if you're familiar with the mini tour game, you pay $1,500 just to play in this thing, right? And you're paying for hotels, you're paying for a car, you know, maybe you drove there, whatever, but you're still going to be in the whole $2,500 at least for the week, right? And you do that 6 or 7, 8 times in a row, and you've got, you know, limited money to play with in the beginning, you're going to start thinking about selling insurance before you know it.
Right.
Even if you are a first team All-American. So I was really down, you know, up until that week in San Francisco, and finishing fourth there, I lost to Webb Simpson by two in the Open and made a lot of money. I mean, I think I made $280,000, and I might've had 1500 bucks to my name at that point.
Oh, wow.
So what that did was it gave me a long runway to where I could play golf more freely. Right. I wasn't worried about making my apartment rent the next week. And so after that week, I started to get more sponsor exemptions into PGA Tour events. And I got a sponsor invite to a Korn Ferry Tour event. And that made me enough money in 2012 at the culmination of the year to get me status the next year on the Korn Ferry Tour. So I started 2013 with a Korn Ferry Tour card, which was a massive deal.
And when did you decide that maybe this wasn't going to be your destiny?
You mean professional golf?
Correct. Yeah.
Well,
tough decision too.
That is hard. So I didn't really like professional golf as far as the travel went, and I loved college golf because there was the team aspect, and
right.
Always were traveling with your best friends and your coaches. You're all working towards a common goal. Okay. And I love that. I love representing LSU. I love representing the state of Louisiana. I grew up in Louisiana. And so I love that. And then you take that guy out of that team game and you feel very isolated and alone.
Okay.
If you don't have, you know, support group around you. And a lot of these guys that are coming out of school now, you see them have nutritionists and swing coaches, caddies, and they have, you know, four or five guys around them at all times because they can afford it.
Right.
I wasn't in the position, and I don't think anyone my age was back then, unless you came from a lot of money, but we didn't have that. You know, he was like, all right, congratulations. You won the national championship. Now good luck as a pro, you know?
Right.
So I really was lonely, and I didn't really like being alone. I didn't really like, you know, not knowing people around me, and I've never had a problem making friends, but you know, all of a sudden I'm the youngest guy on the PGA Tour in 2013, or one of them. It was me and Harris English, I think, were the youngest two at 22 or 23. And so I had a couple friends, but everybody back then, your prime golf years were considered in your mid 30s.
Right.
15 years ago. Now it's certainly in your mid 20s.
Sure.
So everybody back then, the guys in their prime back then were the Matt Kuchers, the Boo Weeklies, David Toms, legends of the game. And I was just this young 23-year-old, you know, fresh out of college that just got his card. So I was lonely, you know, and I didn't really have a ton of people to lean on out there. I wasn't married yet and didn't have kids, obviously. So once I got married and had kids, it got a little bit better on tour. But right at that point, I started having injuries, and I had two torn ligaments in my wrist. I also had a carpal boss in my left wrist and had surgeries on both. After the second surgery, we had had our second child, and I knew for me to be the father that my father was, I could not travel and be gone all the time.
Right.
I had a fantastic example of a man in my house growing up that I wanted to be. And some guys can do it. Some guys can be great fathers and play on the PGA Tour for decades, but I couldn't do it. You know, I wasn't going to drag four kids on a Delta flight in 35E, you know, from place to place to place to place every week and have them homeschooled. Sure. And all that. So I decided to hang it up in 2019. And that was after my second wrist surgery. I still had status on the Korn Ferry Tour and decided to forego it and look to join the real world. And, you know, life, making a dollar outside of golf was very difficult for me for a while because it's all I knew. And I had to quickly learn business and negotiations and all these things that I was behind on as a 30-year-old that guys had been doing, you know, that were my age for 8 years.
Tough decisions and a tough place to be, I'm sure. So then you got into business, you did that. And then how long does it take after you've been playing pro golf to get your amateur status back? You have to apply for it. And how does that, what's that process like?
It varies for everybody.
Okay.
So every condition is weighed in a different way with the USGA, but you usually have a point of contact with the USGA. And okay. I think there's might be a dozen of them, but they get hundreds of these amateur reinstatement applications every year. So mine was a very particular case because I had had multiple years on the PGA Tour, multiple years on the Korn Ferry Tour, where I had made some money on both and played for 7 or 8 years on both. So because I didn't win out there and I wasn't vested within the retirement plans, they decided to give me 5 years from my last check over $1,000, which was June of 2019.
Okay.
So I got the 5 years based on an arbitrary sliding scale that they have that they do not publicize, but they basically convene and they come up with a number. Most guys get it back in under a year. If you've never played on the tour or, you know, you just, you know, made some money on many tours out of college and you went and got a real job after that, you can get it back in under a year. I'd say 95% of guys get it back in under a year.
Did that frustrate you that it was going to be 5 years instead of what you knew others were having, maybe a year or two?
I thought mine was fair. I thought my time was fair because I had known, you know, a couple guys that have gotten longer.
Okay.
And you know, I know of two guys off the top of my head that have got 6 to 7 and then one that had 9. Wow. So but those guys made almost $9 million. You know, I wasn't near that. So I knew that going in. And I think my expectations were multiple years. So I wasn't surprised when I got 5. And at the time of my reinstatement, when I reapplied, I had already been waiting 3 years. So my second reinstatement phase was really just a 2-year wait.
Right. All right. So now we come up into 2025 and all of a sudden you now have your amateur status back and you want to try and do Jones Cup again. How is that coming back from 2011 to the competition of these young bucks out there in 2026? I mean, you and I talked a little bit. I said we were going to do an interview, which we're doing now, but how was it coming back, the difference in the competition out there?
It's Rich, it's not like anything I've ever seen in golf before. And I got a little taste of it last year. I played with Jacob Modleski in the sectionals for U.S. Open final qualifying up in Springfield. And he was a Walker Cupper. I knew he was really good. And
right.
I beat him by a couple, but I was really impressed with him for all 36 holes. The demeanor that these kids have, they carry a head on their shoulders like they're mid-30s. You know, they're obviously in their best shape physically of their life also. And a lot of these kids, they grow up now and they are trained to hit the ball as far as possible, as young as possible. And when I was growing up, that's not how we trained. We trained position golf, right? Hit it here, hit it straight. That's that sort of thing. So I was blown away when I walked on the practice tee at Jones Cup and I see these kids flying driver at sea level. It's 60 degrees and they're flying at 315 yards, every one of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's great. Like, I wish I had that kind of speed. But what I also noticed when I'm playing with these kids, I played with the kid that won the Jones Cup Junior. His name is escaping me, but I think he was 17. And played with him and Modleski the first 2 days or the first day. And this 17-year-old kid, he flew it 40 yards past me. He's looking at the bunker. I'm looking at bunkers he's not even looking at. And what they don't do, though, yet is make great decisions.
Right.
They don't really make effective course management calls on their own. If they're carrying their own bag, they will make a dumb decision every 9 holes. I played with a kid from Florida. He's a freshman. In the second round, he hit driver on number 1 at Ocean Forest. And he's flying at 320 yards. And there may be a 6 foot area for that to go in. And guess what? He hit it right in that 6 foot area. but
of course he did.
Yeah. But you try to do that, you know, that's going to catch up with you. And, and it did. He shot a lot. And, but I think as far as talent goes, as a pool of talent, these kids are ready to play on tour right away. And you know, we weren't ready to play on tour right out of college. You know, maybe there was 10 of us that were, but as a whole, we were not. No.
Well, I enjoyed our brief conversation at the Jones Cup. I've enjoyed tonight. And John Peterson, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us here on the Back Nine Boys.
Yeah, you bet, Rich.
This is Gary Cope, former PGA Tour winner and NBC golf analyst. You're listening to the Back Nine Boys.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Rich Stiles. We're with Phil Smith of Phil Smith Design. And Phil, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So you've worked with Jack Nicklaus, you've worked with Tim Weisskopf, and you have worked with Phil Smith. Which one of those, which one influenced you the most? Or maybe a better way to say that is, what did you learn from Jack? What did you learn from Tom that helped you get into your own design business?
Well, I'll go back even farther. You know, Jay Morish started his career with Jack Nicklaus and did a great job working with Jack, and then partnered up with Tim Weisskopf later on in his career. And so I think when I came over, you know, I worked with Jack for 10 years in the 1990s, pretty much from 1990 to 1999. Started with Tim in 1999, but it was an easy transition for me because Jay and his principles had sort of spilled over between the two. Of course, I probably learned more just out of the gate with Jack because I was young and stupid and naive and just learning the, you know, the skills, but and, you know, I did a lot of different things with Jack. I was a design coordinator. You know, I was in their Hong Kong office doing their production. You know, back then we used to hand draw everything before the computer systems were all built up. So I was sort of their draftsman in Asia. We had 35 projects, I think, at one time in that Asian region. So, but then coming back to the United States and working with Jack, with Lyle Anderson, who we did the Desert Mountain courses and Superstition Mountain. And so I was lucky enough to have a good owner with Jack that, you know, I was able to, you know, I think there was a nice free flow of communication between he and Lyle. And it was a really nice dynamic. But really, it was Tim that taught me client relation and just, you know, Tim was so into golf course design, whereas Jack was torn between, he had a big company and, you know, there was a lot going on with his large company. Plus we had 25 other design associates, you know, but with Tim, that was just he and I. And so the communication was much more dynamic. It was a daily communication. And Tim always joked with me. He said, you know, Jack beat me in my first career. Now let's go beat him in my second career. And so he was motivated and stayed motivated by Jack Nicklaus his entire life. And I thought that was an interesting dynamic that he still felt that competition with Jack, even throughout his design career. So it was a lot of fun working for Tim.
And that kind of surprised you a little bit that Tim was just as competitive in the design business as he was on the golf course with Jack?
It did. You know, I could see it, though. I mean, I really saw in his designs. I mean, he did Troon Country Club in late 80s and won Best New Course right out of the gate. I mean, who does that, right? So you knew he had the skill. And he used to go over to Desert Highlands and watch. And you know, he was a sponge. And he hung out with Jack when he was doing some designs here in Scottsdale. And so he learned it, you know, from Jack and from Jay and from, the you know, those guys. And you know, there was a lot going on back in that time. So there were a lot of great projects that were coming up, a lot of great sites. You're, you know, a lot of times you're only as good as your property and your owner. And he was lucky enough to really, really land some good clients. So I think that helped him.
Phil, are right now in your projects, are you doing more restoration / refresh or brand new project?
Yeah, I think everybody is, unless you're Tom Doak or you know, David McClay Kidd, you know, there's a few guys out there that, you know, Gil Hans does a lot of renovations, but we're all doing a lot of renovations. I'm doing a few new projects, but yeah, I think that's the, you know, all of these golf courses have a lifespan and they're all kind of reaching that age. I never thought I would create my own market, but I certainly did in doing courses in the 90s and the early 2000s, because they're all hitting that wall where the irrigation systems need to be replaced and, you know, everything, the bunkers and all that. But, and there's some new technologies out there that we're implementing that can really help prolong the life of golf courses even farther.
What is the lifeline of a golf course? Is it 15 years, 20, 25, or does that depend on the climate and where they are?
Yeah, it does. It depends on the climate, but there's a lot of documentation, a lot of different, you know, studies that have been done. It really comes down when you do a major renovation to the irrigation system, the things you don't see, you know. Right. So once those components wear out, and the old PVC systems, of course, they get brittle and break. These new HDPE systems, where we fuse the pipe rather than glue it, and it's a much thicker walled pipe, there's no lifespan yet. We don't know how long it's going to last. And so this new product that we're putting in now, it is expensive going in the ground, but it could last a lot longer. And then you're talking about your greens, you know, USGA greens can last a long time with good maintenance. But yeah, it's getting better as time has gone on.
Yeah, as the technology improves in a lot of things, I'm sure material wise and technology has improved a lot in golf course design and restoration.
No doubt. You know, and even with bunker liners and keeping the integrity of bunkers, even though they're hazards, everybody wants them to be perfect, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And they aren't. But that's, I mean, of course, their sand games are probably a judge of that as well. But you have done some incredible projects, I mean, all over the country. But I've had the pleasure of playing two of my most favorite golf courses. One was Sherwood Country Club. I got to play that, just so much history and such a gorgeous piece of property. What did you do when you came in to do kind of the restoration of that?
Well, that was a lot of fun, because it was my kind of re-engagement with Jack after several years of, you know, it'd been 15 years since we'd worked together. And so I was lucky enough to be invited to work with them again at Sherwood. But Sherwood, you know, again, it was tired. And that's another golf course that in today's world would never be built, because they have these giant oak trees. And, you know, that site is just such a beautiful piece of property. The golf course just lays right in there. But in today's world, it would take an act of Congress to cut down one tree. Well, and so, yeah, right. You know, just to have an opportunity to sort of re-engage with that client, you know, it's a very high-end sort of Hollywood kind of clientele there, and you know, change the turf style. You know, the turf was really struggling there, so we sand capped that entire golf course. So it was based more on the agronomic side than it was the design side. The design was still pretty strong. We came, you know, Jack made a couple of visits. We did some improvements. You know, I worked with Chris Cochran from his team, and I went in there weekly to, you know, to sort of manage the construction. The contractor, which is Frontier Golf, and we upgraded that golf course now, where it's I don't know what year you played it, but, you know, Neil, the superintendent there, just does an amazing job, and it's pristine. So that was the idea there, to really upgrade the agronomics.
Yeah, for those that don't know, Sherwood Country Club is at Thousand Oaks. We had some dear, dear friends that lived there. When I visited, I had the opportunity to go there. I arrived, by the way, with my golf clubs hanging out the window of a yellow taxi cab. So they knew I was a visitor. All right, let's talk about Big Sky. Such a beautiful, beautiful piece of property up there. I mean, anywhere up there is gorgeous. You did the Yellowstone Club, which I did not get to play, but I did get to play Spanish Peaks. And I've got to tell you, it is one of the most breathtaking golf courses I have ever played. It's kind of like, well, let me hurry up and hit and let me look around.
Yeah. Yeah. Big Sky is a special place. And if you've been watching these shows, Yellowstone or 1923, you understand why people go to Bozeman, the Bozeman area, the Big Sky area in Montana. It's one of those special places on earth. And when we did Yellowstone Club, that was in the year 2000. And the original owner, you know, sort of introduced us to that property. And I always tell this story because the first time Tom and I took a site visit to Yellowstone Club, we did our site visit. We looked around and we said, you think anybody's ever going to, because it was pretty remote. It's so remote back in that corner in that canyon. And we said, you think anybody's ever going to buy a house up here? And Tom's like, nope. So we were dead wrong. I mean, that place is just crawling now with all kinds of development. But Spanish Peaks being the second course actually was a better piece of property. Yellowstone Club is more on just the side slope of the mountain. Great ski resort, or guy, I shouldn't say resort, great private ski mountain at Yellowstone Club. But Spanish Peaks is something special. And we flew that in a helicopter. The land planner took a snowmobile. Tom decided, well, let's take a helicopter. There was still snow on the ground. We got back and, you know, we were just blown away by the property. And we got back and the land planner that had taken the snowmobile had wrecked his snowmobile and broken his leg. So we were glad we took the helicopter.
Yeah, exactly. But,
you know, that property, is the reason there are so many great landforms and land features on Spanish Peaks is it's seismic. And there's a lot of movement in that property. The land is still moving. And our 18th green actually moved and slid down the mountain and had to be rebuilt a few years ago. So there's a lot of, you know, dynamic soils kind of things going on, but it creates these cool slides and these cool little benches for golf course features. And so that's part of the cool dynamic of that.
Well, you said the Yellowstone Club you built in 2000. Is that a club now that you're looking at to kind of do a refresh or a restoration, so to speak?
Yeah, I go in every year. We do 2 to 3 holes a year. They can't close the course for renovation because your season is so short there and the members, you know, they want to play golf. And so every year we're starting a big irrigation renovation this year, which will be a couple of holes at a time. We actually added a hole so that we can, it's actually a 19 hole golf course now so that we can close a hole and still have that hole open. They have the luxury of being able to do that. I'm also doing work at Spanish Peaks. We're doing a bunker renovation there right now. So it's always, you know, those mountain courses, it's always tricky because the season is so short. We never know when we're going to, the winter seems to go into June nowadays.
Right.
And the fall, you know, it stays pretty mild in October. So we're able to kind of hit that July, August, September window for construction.
In the bunker renovations that you're doing, some clubs are doing them flatter rather than deeper to make it easier for guests and especially members to play. Is that part of your game plan now going forward, or are you still doing deep bunkers that it's hard to see the pins?
Well, the faces away from you are deep, but the walk-ins are, you know, we're very conscious of ingress and egress. You know, none of us are getting any younger. So it's important to keep the lead-ins low. So you're just walking straight in. But the faces, we always still like, and Tom was always, you know, I call it the Weisskopf bunker, the big flash of sand. And that's the dynamic. That's the presentation off the tees and in the landing areas that you want. You want to see that sand. At least that's the way Tom was. You know, Pete Dye liked to kind of keep his sand in the bottom and kind of grasp the faces.
Right.
But Tom really liked the flash. And now with these new bunker liners, you can keep the sand on those faces even when it rains. So it's nice to be able to have both, the best of both worlds, where you get easy to walk in and out of, great playability, and the maintenance of them is a lot easier too.
Are you doing less bunkers when you go in for a restoration, or more, or let's say, as Mark Love once told me, strategically placed bunkers?
Yeah, I think that's a good term. I mean, we used to get a little bit crazy with bunkering, and Tom, you know, toward the end of his life, he was like, I don't want to average any more than 54 bunkers on a golf course. That's 3 per hole. That's not that many. I probably personally would do a little bit more just because they really set the style of the golf course, you know? And so, and it depends on scale. The scale of a bunker and the bunkering on a golf course is so important. And you'll notice it when you play golf courses, like golf courses that are in heavily treed areas, we bring our scale of the bunkers down a little bit. when we're out in the open, when you're out in the, you know, wide open areas, the scale gets bigger. And so it's got to fit that frame. It's got to fit your eye and not hurt your eye when you're looking at it. So there's a lot that goes into it. So it's more, to me, it's more the square footage than it is the number of bunkers. You can split a great big bunker up into 10 bunkers and it's less square footage, right?
Yeah, just 10 more places for you to put your ball. Thanks.
That's right. That's right.
Phil, can't thank you enough for being with us. I appreciate it. And I appreciate everything you've done. I was just fortunate enough to play some of the courses that you had worked with, and just incredible work.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate you having me on. If you ever get a chance to get to St. George, Utah, you need to go see Black Desert. Check that one out. That's an amazing golf course. That was the last one Tom and I did together.
You've just created a new bucket list for me. Thanks.
Great.
All right, Phil, thanks.
Thank you. Take care.
Hey, everyone. This is Tracy West. I'm tournament director for the Valspar Championship, and you are listening to the Back Nine Boys podcast.
Welcome back. I'm Rich Stiles. We are with Hudson Swafford, formerly of the PGA Tour, most recently with LIV in the past couple of years. Hudson, thanks for doing this interview with us.
Yeah, absolutely. Appreciate having me, Rich.
So you have three PGA Tour wins, none on the LIV Tour. Kind of tell me what was going through your head after you won the American Express in January 2022. And then when you signed with LIV in June 2022, what happened in that 6 months?
Yeah, it was obviously a good time, just one. But that win was kind of masked by some good iron play and some putting. I think I led the field in strokes gained putting. I think I was like almost 12 strokes gained putt plus 12 strokes gained putting. But it was a great week. Actually had so a really good like start to that season. Played good at the Masters. They're solid at the Masters. Played really solid the next week at Harbortown. And I was having a chance to win before I actually hit a ball out of bounds on 15 and made double. But there was a lot of things. I'd kind of started talking to LIV early on, just before the Masters. I wanted to go play the London event because I was not vaccinated and couldn't go to Canada. And so I approached the tour and asked them, you know, if I could get a release, because they've released me in the past to go play in DP World Tour events that, you know, coincided with PGA Tour events. And they said no. So basically the tour dictated where I could and couldn't make a living. What's going, you know, at that time period, like I could not, there was no Korn Ferry event there. I couldn't go play in Canada. And there was a lucrative opportunity that was presenting itself, not on U.S. soil. And so, yeah, I mean, first time ever that guys got to play for a $4 million winner check, go to London. It seemed kind of harmless to me, to be honest with you. So I started asking more questions when the tour would not release me. I didn't initially sign on with them then. Kind of took some time and thought about it, and then kind of put it on the back burner for a little while. Then I took 3 weeks off because we had my daughter, Amy, our second child, kind of right after Hilton Head. So I took 3 or 4 weeks off and, just kind of to process everything, to have our second child. And so, yeah, that was kind of what, you know, that was kind of the process after the American Express. Then I went to, I believe it was, I want to say it was Byron Nelson. Started back in Byron Nelson after a month off and played that week and really was kind of struggling just physically. My right hip was really bothering me. I wasn't able to perform and do what I wanted to do. Had to get a shot in my hip before the PGA the next week. Really played very poorly and couldn't really move. And so the talks kind of resurfaced on LIV. You know, I had four, I mean, my hip surgery ended up being my fourth surgery. So yeah, I mean, there was a lot of components that kind of played into it between right. American Express and the time of going to LIV.
Were you upset with the PGA Tour that they did not approve of you wanting to go play that event since they had approved it times before?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It just didn't make sense to me. I totally understand not playing on U.S. soil. I understand that if I could have gone to Canada, then, you know, maybe that could have been a problem. But yeah, I was pretty upset that, you know, you could show up and make a pretty big check and have a pretty lucrative opportunity to go make a good check if you played some really good golf. Yeah. And basically they were handcuffing me and saying, you can't make a living this week and right. provide for your family. So right. yeah, I mean, I thought that was a little difficult.
Yeah. Especially as
I don't know why. I don't know why they have that kind of jurisdiction over kind of what we can and can't do.
Since you're a contract employee. Yeah. So, you know, you should be able to play wherever you wanted to.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So you go in and live. Did you like the format? Did you, you know, enjoy it as much as you did on the PGA Tour?
Yeah, I definitely enjoyed LIV. I always told people I thought they ran a great event. A lot of guys did, you know, work their tails off to get these events going.
Yeah.
The actual events were, you know, were run well, you know, and created a different buzz, a different crowd, especially, you know, some the international events. They did a really good job. I thought the first year when we actually played like a team format at Miami, that really, that atmosphere and that team format was really fun. It really kind of hooked me then for sure. And I thought, man, this really has some legs because there was right. great crowds in Miami. There was, you know, interesting format. People were rooting, getting behind it. So I was pretty excited about it, to be honest. But like everything, I mean, LIV's a startup. There's bumps and bruises. The rules changed on the fly, which I thought was kind of BS. And then in the second year, when they kind of just, you know, everything they kind of sold us on, which, you know, is always a possibility, but they right. just kind of dropped the official world golf ranking process. There was a couple other things that they were kind of hammering and promising, and they just kind of, you know, stopped pursuing it. So I thought that was kind of, you know, petty on the startup. I mean, you still got to fight for all the guys that came over.
All right. So at this point, what is your status? And you're not on LIV and you're not yep. a member of the PGA Tour at this time. So what have they told you when you can come back? And what are the conditions? Well,
I am a member of the PGA Tour, just okay. not in good standing. Yeah, my membership's just suspended right now.
Okay.
And so I'll be able to play on the PGA Tour in 27. What that looks like is really TBD because the PGA Tour is really changing quickly. I'll only have past champion status. I think I'm planning on playing the American Express next year. It's within the window of me winning recently. You know, I'd love to play that and a couple other events. But I don't know if there's lots of rumors flying that they're going to shrink their schedule, get rid of a number of events. The past champion status is just really not going to be relevant on the PGA Tour going forward. I just don't think that will get in any events, which I see, you know, it's good and bad, right? Guys that have supported tour, won on your tour, performed at the highest level on your tour. Yeah, do guys that are like, you know, 50 kind of lingering with past champion status and maybe get in one-off events, like maybe that does need to be cleaned up. But, you know, guys that are actively trying to play, you know, it definitely hinders that past champion status if, you know, if you've kind of struggled for a couple of years and then it's kind of really over unless you go to Q school and perform and get back in the top five.
Right.
But, But, you know, it's just like anything. You got to have some changes. And right now it's a very lucrative deal for professional golfers. They're making tons of money. They're playing against a lot of the good players are playing a lot more now because of the unknowns. So I think that's good. So fields are stronger, but I still think there needs to be a world that this kind of needs to come together because golf's just not big enough to be split, if you will. But so I just kind of wait and see how it plays out. But yeah, I'm planning to play a few events here and there. Kind of starting the second, you know, maybe in the fall, play a couple events. I got to get my game in shape. But I want to play Amex, but then I've heard some rumors that maybe they won't have Amex anymore, won't fit in the schedule because they want to start after the Super Bowl and then they want to stop, you know, in September time. So the schedule is going to get condensed. So we'll just kind of see where it kind of plays out.
It's really changed since you left the PGA Tour. You know, less tournaments, there's more money, and now there's less players that can qualify to play on the tour. I mean, you've got a lot of players who have had PGA Tour wins playing that 101 to 125 slot who are trying to get into events and can't. Yep. So is that one of the big changes that you think has happened since you left?
Oh, yeah, that's definitely one of them. You know, obviously going to 100 cards is significant. You know, when there was probably basically 230 members when I was kind of playing that were eligible to play across the PGA Tour for the whole year. You know, maybe not everybody got in, but there was definitely – it would go over the 200 number for sure.
Right.
Because there was more than 200 people with FedEx Cup points, obviously. But – you know, I don't know if that's good or bad. I think having that system where you have guys and names kind of do resurface and create a cool storyline of a, you know, an older past champion coming back and getting in the mix, I think that's pretty fun. But that's obviously going to go away here in the near future. And I see what guys are saying that there's still going to be some turnover, but there's just really not going to be a ton of turnover going forward with 100 cards going to, you know, what I've heard in rumors is going to be more like a 24 event schedule.
Oh, wow.
Which I don't know if it needs to be quite that, but I was always a big advocate of having some time off in the fall. We were the only sports that didn't have an off season. No offense to RSM, but I really didn't like playing all the way up to the week of Thanksgiving. It's just kind of late in the year. It's been a long year. You know, and I just mentally, you get kind of burned out on it.
Oh, sure.
So we always pushed to have an off season. We kind of wanted to starve our fans and get them hungry again for golf when it started back up in January. You know, whether we could have October, November, December off, that would have been huge, where we kind of ended at the beginning of college football, NFL football, and then, you know, kind of starved our fans for at least, you know, 3 full months to where they were excited when we started back in January. And, you know, tour executives weren't, that's not how they made a living. They made a living on more playing opportunities and more sponsors. So
they were going to
try to play as many events as possible. Right. Obviously that narrative has definitely changed, which I think is actually pretty good. I think there needs to be an off season. I think there needs to be recovery time. I think we need to starve our fans for good quality golf.
Yeah. And, you know, with the old schedule, I mean, you really had to fight for getting some time off. And you really didn't want to take too much time off because you thought you were missing out and you wanted to get back out there in order, you know, since your contract, you want to make some money and play competitively. But with less tournaments, and as you said, with all the stuff going on with the restrictions here and, you know, going down to 100 less tournaments, it's really going to get hard for you.
Yeah.
So what's your game plan from today forward?
I don't know on golf wise, just kind of taking it day by day. let this weather kind of warm up and start getting back into it. I'll probably do US Open qualifying. Maybe a couple other events kind of second half of the year. I would love to go play Dunhill Links again. It's turned in one of my favorite events. I know the weather can not be great, but it's just a great gathering of guys. And Johan Rupert puts on an incredible event at some incredible golf courses. Maybe do a couple other events and then just kind of get ready, maybe, and then go play American Express if they continue to have that event, which I hope they do. I mean, it's such a great place to, you know, get the first half of the year really kind of going. And it's pro-am, so you interact with a bunch of guys that you probably never would have. Right. I've always enjoyed meeting people there. We'll just kind of wait and see there. But you probably know I'm kind of doing some commercial real estate stuff.
Right.
Working with a multifamily developer out of Atlanta, which I've really enjoyed to getting to know and get to know all the guys in the office, and great group and really successful group, vertically integrated. So learning kind of, you know, everything from top to bottom, the whole process. And I've been enjoying that and kind of getting away from golf while I've been struggling.
Well, I'm sure your game will come back. I mean, you just got to work on it just like all of us. And we wish you all the luck in the world, Hutton. Thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Absolutely. Thanks, Rich.
All right. Take care.
You've been listening to the Back Nine Boys Golf Show with Rich Stiles. Go to back9boys.com for all things golf whenever you want it. We'll be back next week with an all-new Back Nine Boys at back9boys.com.